Great to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope you have a wonderful weekend going. We begin with critics Claudia Puig and Christy Lemire on Tully, starring Charlize Theron. Jason Reitman directing the film. Diablo Cody wrote it. They collaborated on the hit Juno, which hard to believe is 11 years ago that came out. Tully, Claudia, what'd you think of the film?
I really liked it. I think Jason is back informed. The original films that you were just talking about, Juno, he kind of had deviated and done some films that weren't so great, like Labor Day. But the best thing about this film is Charlize Theron's performance. She gives this like spot-on performance of this exhausted, tired, but loving, very complicated person, a young mother, a mother with a brand new baby and two other children. And I think she may be the screen's most versatile actress. And when you think about her going from Furiosa in Mad Max Fury Road to Atomic Blonde to this, I mean, if that's Furiosa, she's exhaustina in this one. But she and the film nail the messiness of raising kids and what that's like, and you know, to be the parent of a new baby and all the emotions that go along with it. I thought it's probably one of the more honest films I've ever seen about child rearing.
She just throws herself all into these
roles. She does completely. I mean, you think about Monster, of course, but she, you know, and it's a cliche to say, oh, you know, they have no, you know, sense of, she, you know, no vanity or anything like that. But it's true. She has no vanity and she just becomes these characters. I actually think she's probably the most versatile actress working.
Wow.
She's not afraid to go to dark places, yes, or get messy, but there's also a lot of humor here and a lot of honest humor, and just that it's intimately detailed, but also it's got this great narrative ambition. And she and Mackenzie Davis, she plays the night nurse who comes to her house to help her when she has a newborn and two other kids to juggle.
Her brother pays, yes, for her because they're struggling. She and Ron Livingston, her husband.
Yeah. They're a middle-class family. She's 40. She had a baby that maybe wasn't planned. And so now a newborn has come along. And she and Mackenzie Davis have amazing chemistry with each other. And at first, Mackenzie Davis seems like a manic pixie dream girl. Mm-hmm. Or I called her in my RogerEbert.com review a nanny pixie dream girl, because she seems quirky and light and perky. But there's a lot more to her. And their bond deepens over the nights as they get to know each other.
It's much more about their bond than her bond with her husband or brother or anybody else.
Or it's really even the two women. They're the central.
Yes, they are.
It is. And it is really surprisingly very emotional by the end. And it's sneaks up on you, and I loved it. I was blown away by
it. Yeah, I really did too. Yeah, but we should say it is also effective birth control. You'll see the grittiness of having children, so just keep that in mind.
Tully is, and Mackenzie Davis, the co-star, strong performance.
Yes. She's in a show called Halt and Catch Fire, and she's got a lovely way about her, and she's a light compared to the darkness of Charlize's character, and then they meet sort of in the middle and really evolve together. It's beautiful.
Tully is the film, written by Diablo Cody. Jason Reitman, the director, Charlize Theron and Mackenzie Davis stars, rated R in wide release. Overboard, a remake of the 1987 comedy that starred Goldie Hawn and Kurt Russell, which wasn't that a remake of an Italian movie?
I thought it was remake of a remake.
Yeah, right. Anna Faris, Eva Longoria, Eugenio Derbez, co-star in the film that's directed by Rob Greenberg, who's one of the co-screenwriters as well. Christy, what did you think of the new Overboard?
I think you're thinking of Swept Away. Right?
Lena Wertmüller.
That's why I believe the original Overboard.
Giancarlo
Giannini. Very good. You pulled that right
out. Thank you. It's all my brain's a sieve.
That's good.
Madonna made the remake.
That was terrible.
That? Yeah, and Giancarlo Giannini was in that one.
This is not as interesting as the Madonna version of Swept Away, I would say. So Eugenio Derbez, who's a superstar in Mexico, is the wealthy one here, the wealthy, awful, arrogant person here. This is a gender swap to this remake. And Anna Faris plays this hardworking, single mother of three, and she's working a carpet cleaning job, but also studying to be a nurse, right? And so she goes to his yacht to clean up one of his many messes, and he goes overboard. And anyway, through a convoluted series of events, she ends up hooking up with him, even though he has amnesia, and bringing him back to her home to make him think that he's her husband and the father of their children,
and
just
not
to get back
up
at
in
him.
The contemporary sense.
No, she sort of claims him at the hospital, and it's very high concept and feels like an 80s movie, but not in the good ways. Like it's a remake of a 1987 comedy, but it hasn't in any way evolved from the kind of really broad, like really thin, high concept, slapsticky comedy.
It's the remake nobody needed. I mean, this is not a particularly great film, and the original one, I guess, was, you know, more resting on the chemistry between Goldie Hawn and Kurt Russell. But the thing I have to say, though, as a person who feels very strongly about more movies for the Latino audience, and that we need to make more movies for the Latino audience, about the Latino audience, not only is that just a hugely underserved audience, but it's good business, right? Because there's huge percentages of Latinos go to the movies. So this film is partially in Spanish, which is kind of, I like, and it's got subtitles. It has Eugenio Derbez, who is a huge comic star in Mexico. He was in How to Be a Latin Lover. As uneven as that movie was, I think it might have been better than this one. You know, he's an engaging, charismatic actor. He just chooses some really bad, very broad slapstick vehicles. And it's too bad because I think with the right subject matter, he would be great. And I'd like to see more of him. I'd like to see a role that's worthy of his comic skills and sort of affable charm.
Well, and Anna Faris is very talented.
Oh, I love her too.
But
she just
does
a lot of kind of wide-eyed Goldie Hawn thing. And, you know, the more desperate they become, the more they start to like physically gesticulate. And it's just, you have a couple, Eva Longoria has a small part, very thankless role. It just is just, you know, a throwaway movie. Yeah. There's a couple funny moments.
Throwaway,
Overboard.
Appropriate.
Abandoned ship.
Flotsam. Overboard is the film remake of the 87 Goldie Hawn Kurt Russell movie. It's rated PG-13 in wide release. We continue on Film Week with Christy and Claudia looking at 12th Man, a Norwegian film that's directed by Harald Svart. Claudia, what'd you think?
This was a really, really good film. It's thrilling. It's tense. It's very detailed in the depiction. This is about a true story about a Norwegian fighter who decides to. Norway was, of course, under the thumb of the Germans, and he is a resistance fighter, and he, along with 11 others, who are unfortunately dispensed with, and he manages to escape. It takes him 2 months and through this grueling countryside up in the Arctic, which actually it meant something to me because I'd been to this area, Lofoten Islands in Norway, a couple of years ago, and he actually shot it there, and you could feel.
Remember you saying how beautiful?
Oh my gosh, it's gorgeous, and you see the northern lights and everything in this. And basically, he is aided and abetted by, you know, people who are really risking their lives, the Norwegian people in the countryside, and you see, you know, what he goes through, and physically the gangrene that, you know, he's in frozen water. You really get a sense of his journey, and it's one of the few World War II stories that you didn't know, and it feels fresh and new.
It's an intense, visceral experience. It is shot so beautifully, it is edited so beautifully, and it's physical. Like, I was cringing. Mm-hmm. There are scenes where I couldn't look at them straight on. I had to look through splayed fingers. But having said that, the grotesquerie, the violence, whatever, is never gratuitous. It's absolutely germane to this man and his journey when you see what he goes through to survive. And Harald Svart, I don't know how he has this movie in him. He made Agent Cody Banks, the remake of The Karate Kid, and some terrible throwaway YA movie, The Mortal Instruments, something Bones, from like 5 years ago. Terrible YA thing with like vampires.
Wow.
You would never know that this person had this kind of, it's
intense. This is like The Revenant. It feels kind of that gritty, you know,
and
survival
it's,
drama.
But like subtle, and it's so beautiful, and the severity of the terrain is almost like a character, and the people who come to help him, like, everyone makes a really important contribution, and there's a great connection that he has with each of them, and you feel their spirit and what he begins to represent for them, you know, being occupied by the Nazis. Just saving him means so much more than just saving him.
It doesn't sound like a dialogue-heavy movie.
No. It is in German and Norwegian with subtitles. And then Jonathan Rhys-Meyers pops up, an Irish actor who seems to be speaking good German. I don't speak German,
I don't know.
I don't know.
But he's always got, like, a creepy, unsettling presence about him.
He
just
does.
His eyes and his cheekbones. Like, he shows up and you know he's going to be a bad guy.
Yeah, he's very effective in this. Everything about this film, I thought it really worked. Really it was very, it felt just beautifully rendered.
It's very long, though, is the only thing.
Oh, yeah.
12 hours, 10 Norwegian, right?
Yes.
They'll make short movies. 12th Man is the film. Stars Tomas Gulstad, Jonathan Rhys-Meyers. Harold Ward is the director. Petter Skavlan is the screenwriter. It's unrated. You can see 12th Man at the Arena Cinelounge Sunset in Hollywood. The documentary RBG looks at the life and the career of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, film co-directed by Julie Cohen and Betsy West. Christy?
Directed by two women, and a lot of the main crew members are all female as well, the DP, the composer, the editor. So I love that.
Yay.
About it.
Yeah.
So you think you know who Ruth Bader Ginsburg is. There is so much to her that is so enlightening and so surprising and so inspiring in this film. This is definitely not a warts and all depiction of the Supreme Court
justice.
But it's
not hagiography either. It stops just short.
I mean, it's quite worshipful of her,
it
though,
is worshipful.
But justifiably so. Like,
yeah.
She, in celebrating her for the important work she's done for many, many decades. So, and also, it made me want to go to the gym. Because the first thing you see is Ruth Bader Ginsburg working out with her trainer. And she's 84 years old and spry and sharp and more necessary than ever.
See, it had the opposite effect. I mean, it's like enough shots of the gym. We know she's in good shape.
Well,
she's 84.
She's made that herself. I think a big part of talking about herself is how committed she is to her workout.
She's committed to everything. Yeah. She is a woman who like kind of defines the word commitment, I think, in so many ways.
Yeah. And so you see, you know, how she began her career and was at Harvard Law School. And when there were only like 9 women at Harvard Law School.
Out of 500. Yeah.
And then
her granddaughter. It's at 50% by the time her granddaughter gets to Harvard Law School, which
I
thought was a wonderful...
Yeah, no, that's great.
Yeah.
Evolution's happening.
Yeah.
But it's about the important case law, the important ways that she's fought for women's rights and for equal rights and equal pay, and will then also has taken cases fighting for men who are staying at home with their children who also, you know, need representation. And so just to see the evolution of her thinking and her philosophy and what matters to her and what she fights for, that's all interesting. But also you see her as a person. We go to her chambers and we see the various collars that she wears with her robe and
that
what they mean.
People have given her. Yeah, people like stitch and embroider these collars and they give them to her. And you also, one of the things I loved about it was she had this wonderful marriage. And it worked in really interesting ways for that era. He stayed home and cooked. She was a terrible cook. And that's the one maybe negative thing we hear about her. The kids say, you know, we couldn't stand her food. He cooked and he had to go to the office when she was still a lawyer and say, you know, Ruth, it's time to come home. It's time to eat dinner. She'd stay up to all hours, you know, working. And you find this wonderful love story. And they were married for a very long time. And she moved with him, but she and at times he had to lobby. And I think he did lobby for her for Supreme Court justice. And then Clinton, they have, you know, people who are interviewed are Nina Totenberg, Gloria Steinem, Bill Clinton. So some real luminaries, obviously. But Bill Clinton says, no, within 10 minutes, I knew it was her. I knew I was going to make her the Supreme Court justice. But it's interesting to see, you know, she is very soft-spoken. She has this friendship with Antonin Scalia, which I thought was fascinating. She loves opera, and you see her actually dressed up in an opera costume. You really get a sense of who this amazing woman is. And not only the fact that she's, you know, paved the way for women and changed so many things. You have Gloria Steinem calling her a superhero, but you get a kind of behind the curtain view.
It'd be interesting now if this starts a whole spate of justice documentaries where each of the justices gets a profile.
I don't think anyone's as notorious RBG as it. I think she's the most notorious and famous.
And she is aware of and she embraces that notorious RBG persona.
It.
And she loves the memes. One of the best parts is when you watch her watching Kate McKinnon
on Saturday Night
doing
Live,
the bit on Saturday Night Live during Weekend Update. And she just gets a kick out of it. Like she's really hilarious and she can laugh at herself.
Well, she's not hilarious. Her husband was really funny, and they had a book, her children had a book saying, "Mom." It was a book entitled Mommy Laughed.
RBG is the documentary. It's rated PG at the Arclight Hollywood and the Landmark Theater in West Los Angeles. Coming up, we'll hear about the drama Bad Samaritan. A couple of burglars break into a home and get a shock. We'll talk about that. And also want to remind you that our next Film Week screening series A movie is The Graduate, Saturday night, June 2nd, 7 o'clock, Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles. I sure hope to see you there. Reserve tickets on sale right now, kpecc.org/in-person. We hope to see you there Saturday night, June 2nd. I've never seen The Graduate on a big screen. I'm looking forward to seeing it in that beautiful venue and with all the 60s references of youth and popular culture at the time as well. Be a great Saturday night. I hope you're there to join us for that. Much more to come in 1 minute. Time is running out on the KPCC online auction Saturday at 1 o'clock. That's when all the bidding ends. So many great experiences, one-of-a-kind sorts of adventures you can take if you're the high bidder. Visit kpcc.org/auction to make your bid right now as we are in the final period here of the online auction. One of the things you can bid for is to come in and watch Film Week. You can actually meet the critics of that week. Come in and watch us do the program, and I'll take you to lunch afterwards close by to our KPCC studios. We can talk about Film Week, about Air Talk. It's a chance for you to turn the tables and interview me. But you got to make your bid right now, kpecc.org/auction. That's just one of dozens and dozens of experiences that are available when you visit kpcc.org/auction. We continue with our critics, Claudia Puig, who's the president of the L.A. Film Critics Association, and Christy Lemire of RogerEbert.com, co-host of YouTube's What the Flick. Our Film Week critics' next movie, Bad Samaritan, Dean Devlin, the director, Brandon Boyce, the screenwriter, Robert Sheehan, Kerry Condon, David Tennant of Doctor Who are the stars of the movie. Christy, what'd you think of Bad Samaritan?
This movie is nuts in all the best possible ways and must be experienced with friends. You can laugh about it and just ask each other questions about how insane it is.
Like we did.
Claudia and I had a really good time.
You go out after the screening and talk?
So many questions, so many things to talk about.
Commented.
Yes, so Robert Sheehan stars as a valet parking attendant. He is a struggling artist. He's a photographer living in Portland, and he and his co-worker at the valet parking stand at an Italian restaurant have the scheme where when they're supposedly parking somebody's car, they actually go to that person's house and they rob them. They figure out from the insurance and the glove box or whatever where they live.
To burgle the house.
Yes. And so
the
figure,
keys are usually on the keys.
Right. And you figure, like, you know, they're at dinner for the next hour. They're not going to be home. They're not going to notice. And one night, they choose the wrong guy to break into his house. This is David Tennant, Doctor Who, in his Maserati, who's clearly a jerk from the get-go. They figure he deserves it more than anybody does. But then when Robert Sheehan gets to the house, this perfectly, like, pristine, minimalist, modern house, so you know he's a bad guy. The glass and stone monstrosity on the hill.
Yeah.
He's not a nice guy. He finds more than he bargained for. And then becomes this bad guy's obsession.
The cat and mouse game.
What if it just been a quaint tutor?
It's for a cute little bungalow.
Yeah, nothing good to steal there. But this is super creepy and very knowingly so. And the bad guy, what's so hilarious, is like he's all-knowing and all-powerful, and supposedly he's some financial analyst, but he has time to like hack into everyone's phones and Facebook and find out personal things to tweak them on to make their lives
their worst nightmares.
So fun. So I mean, he's got a backstory about torment. It doesn't really matter. The whole point is that he's like a machine.
Is this tongue-in-cheek?
Increasingly, I would say.
I don't know if it's meant to be tongue-in-cheek.
I think David Tennant knows he's playing a really hilariously nutty character.
I'm not sure Dean Devlin knows it so much. But it's funny. One of the little tip-offs is in every room of his house, there's a sculpture of a horse. So just think a little Equus maybe going. But that's the little tip-off of his terrible childhood. And he's a trust fund child, too. And It really is fun, but there are times when you're just like, oh my God, this has just gone so far. And we had a good laugh over his hair, which went from stick straight to suddenly permed to
that's his disguise.
His disguise, yes. We can think of better disguises than that.
I thought maybe there's a gap in filming or something.
It was really moist outside that day.
That's right. Well, it is Oregon.
Yeah. But David Tennant is doing this wide-eyed kind of crazy thing,
oh my God.
And he plays with his voice. It's a wide range of his vocal
and
delivery.
And does an American accent really really well.
He does. Anyway, it's really fun. I can't say it's good, but I had a really good time.
Not good, but yeah, a guilty pleasure.
Bad Samaritan is directed by Dean Devlin. It's rated R in wide release. The documentary After Auschwitz is written and directed by John Keane. Claudia?
This is a very powerful documentary. This is there was a Swimming in Auschwitz that came out in 2007. So this is the same women that were featured in John Keane's documentary then about these World War II Holocaust survivors. There are six women, and they went into the concentration camps between the ages of like 18 and 23. And what it explores, I mean, yes, it's done in a very simple way with talking heads and archival footage and occasional voiceover narration, but it's what it explores is what happens when you are lucky enough to not have died in the camps and they say, go home. And where is home? And, you know, everybody you know has been killed more, and you might find one member. And how do you put your life together? And all these women ended up in Los Angeles, as it turns out. And they were Czech, Hungarian, Polish. One of them became a pretty famous fashion designer. Another one was a deli owner. It really captures, you know, the sense of tragedy and also a sense of resilience, incredible sense of the human spirit.
Yeah, it makes you think about a lot of things that maybe would never occur to you in, you know, the many, many films that have been made about the Holocaust and about survivors. Like, right, immediately, what do you do? Where do you go? You have no money. You don't know whether your family is alive. You have maybe nothing to wear, no food. And it's how step by step these women just fortified themselves and figured it out. And all ended up coming to America. And it couldn't be more relevant in terms of the sense of hope these people all felt when they're entering the New York Harbor and they see the Statue of Liberty and the possibilities of, you know, opportunity and redemption and a new life. And it couldn't be more relevant
for
that,
refugees
like, that
and
is
immigrants
still
yes.
so important.
Yes.
And to see that, you know, years ago they had this and America did for them what they hoped it would. And it's really inspiring. And yeah, they all happen to be out in LA now. And this documentary, I want to say, is co-produced through the LA Holocaust Museum at Pan Pacific Park. So that's part of the connection here. But yeah, they all have lovely stories, lovely, vivid stories to tell, and a sense of pride that they now must tell that story and it must be kept alive.
It's always amazing to me of so many of the survivors, you know, who've been in documentaries, what tremendous, relators they are of their experience to
yes.
go through something so unbelievably traumatic and to be able to talk about it so eloquently and to describe things so vividly. It's remarkable.
Some of them go to schools, too, and speak to students about it to keep it alive. And then I think there are others who don't want to talk about it as much. So, there isn't a uniform reaction,
understandable.
Of course.
There'd be some differences. Yeah. When was the previous documentary?
2007.
Yeah, because I remember that was such a terrific film.
Yeah.
And I see there's an updated a decade later, After
yes.
Auschwitz is unrated, the documentary at Lemley's Music Hall in Beverly Hills, Lemley's Town Center in Encino. The documentary Love and Bananas, an Elephant Story, looks at elephant rescuers. The film is directed by Ashley Bell in her directorial debut. Christy?
So Ashley Bell is an actress who has been around for a little while, and she was the star of a horror film from several years back called The Last Exorcism. She has a supporting part in Novitiate, which came out last year, which was really great.
Mm-hmm.
And she originally intended to go to Cambodia and Thailand and make a short film about elephants, about the plight of Asian elephants and how they're becoming increasingly extinct and the horrors that they suffer. But once she got there, she saw that she really needed to spend more time there and really, really shine a light on this. And so she spends a lot of time with this petite
Shalert.
But really powerful Thai woman who runs an elephant sanctuary in Thailand. And so it's a really harrowing film to watch, but really important. And so you see what these elephants have gone through, how they are broken in this thing called a crush box, which is really hard to watch. They're taken from their moms when they're young, and they're really tortured to get that sense of connection out of them, to then be trained to work in a circus or
be ridden on. Yeah.
Or to do like art with their trunk with paint or whatever. And so what they're doing with this film is trying to persuade more and more of these trekking companies to use their elephants and use that space and turn it into a refuge instead. So tourists can still have access to the animals, but in a humane way. And you see the power of when they're free, how like transformational it is. It's a really hard film to watch, but also very beautiful.
It very much is. And it's interesting they make the distinction between the African elephant, who is hunted for its ivory, and the Asian elephants that are used mostly for these kind of trekking and tourist purposes. And they follow this one 70-year-old, partially blind elephant, Noi Na, and it's so for 480 miles across Thailand with this the trainer who was actually one of Time Magazine's Heroes of Asia, and she was recognized by the Clinton administration. All kinds of, you know, she's very well known for the work that she's done because she's just devoted herself to the plight of the elephants. And so you follow along on this journey, and it's harrowing. But you realize how important it is that people realize that you know what's being done to elephants is just such a horribly inhumane thing. And there is a sense of hope at the end, too.
Yeah. The title is not great, but it reflects how that's all these elephants need is some love and some bananas.
And she does a really good job personalizing. It's also beautifully shot, I thought.
Yeah.
Love and Bananas, an Elephant Story, Documentaries Unrated, directed by Ashley Bell at Lemley's Music Hall in Beverly Hills. The comedic drama The Cleanse stars Johnny Galecki, Anna Friel, and Angelica Houston. Bobby Miller, the writer-director in feature directorial debut. Christy?
This is another movie that is nutty in all the best ways, and I really enjoyed it, and it keeps evolving as it goes along, and I was very impressed by that. So Johnny Galecki stars as a guy who's kind of down on his luck in every way. He's lost his job, and his fiance has left him, and he doesn't really have a whole lot going for him. And then one day, while lounging on his couch in his terrible little apartment, he sees an ad on TV for this retreat, this magical retreat, and come with us and change all the things that are wrong with your life. And so he goes, and Angelica Houston is there, and she is the leader of this thing, and she gives each of the participants these tailor-made series of juices, like these drinks that they have to drink to cleanse themselves of the toxins that have been plaguing them. And they drink their drinks, and things happen. And I don't want to say what happens because it's really strange. But I will say this movie morphs pretty beautifully from being a dark comedy to a sci-fi comedy to a flat-out horror film.
This sounds like a pretty complicated undertaking for a first-time director.
There are visual effects. I will say that.
Okay.
There are things that come out of them that require some visual effects, and it's funny and strange and weird, and I liked it.
The Cleanse is rated R at the Vintage Los Feliz Theater. And finally, the French romantic drama Let the Sunshine In, starring Juliette Binoche, Claire Denis, the director and co-screenwriter. Claudia?
Well, I thought Juliette Binoche gave a really rich portrait of this restless woman, but I didn't really feel the movie worked for me. I thought she gave a great performance, but I just felt like it was supposed to be a comedy. Didn't quite feel like it until the very end. You have Gerard Depardieu kind of lumbering in and creating this other moment. It didn't work for me.
She's this divorced woman who is dating various men and kind of trying them all on like a coat to see what fits. And supposedly this is a romantic comedy, you know, but it's through Claire Denis' very dark, very French prism.
Yes.
I mean, yeah, Juliette Binoche cannot help but be lovely and radiant at all times. And there are some moments of humor here and of serious drama. And it's very sexy, too. It's a very graphically sexual film. But yeah, it's just kind of repetitive and it keeps kind of spinning its wheels. And maybe that's the point. That's where this woman is in her life.
Remember that awful song, Looking for Love in All the Wrong Places?
Yes.
It's that.
This
the Gaelic
is that,
version.
Yes. Yeah.
Let the Sunshine In, a French film directed by Claire Denis. It's unrated. Lemley's Royal Theater in West Los Angeles. Coming up, we'll talk about the decision this week of the Motion Picture Academy to expel Bill Cosby and Roman Polanski from membership. We're going to talk about how we watch films with performers or directors attached to them accused of misconduct and whether that changes our perception. Back momentarily. Great to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. In case you just tuned in, you missed the reviews of this week's movies, don't despair. You can hear whenever you want via the Film Week podcast, via your favorite podcasting app, or you can go to kpecc.org and find all of our Film Weeks there. And of course, it airs twice weekly, live every Friday in the 11 o'clock hour and Saturdays at noon, right here on 89.3 KPECC. Well, this week, the Motion Picture Academy, without a lot of explanation, just a very terse statement, said that it had expelled from membership Bill Cosby and Roman Polanski. Polanski pled guilty to sexual assault of a minor back in 1977 and has not been able to return to the United States as a result of the sentence against him that was pending. Of course, Bill Cosby was just days ago convicted on multiple counts of sexual assault. But this opens up the question and renews it as to whether we consider the art of someone separate and apart from the conduct of that individual. Along those lines, this also hits the world of television, where Friday Netflix announced that Jeffrey Tambor will appear in the upcoming season of Arrested Development. Now, you might recall that Tambor left Amazon series Transparent earlier this year. He was accused of misconduct by his former assistant and one of the actresses on the show. Tambor denied the harassment claims and said he was profoundly disappointed in how Amazon handled the matter. But a Netflix spokesperson says Tambor is included in the fifth season of Arrested Development. So my question for you as a Film Week listener, if you are listening live to the Friday 11 o'clock broadcast of the program, do these allegations or convictions of individual for sexual misconduct or assault, does that change how you look at some of the films that you've seen in the past? Now, maybe it's not even a case where there's an allegation of wrongdoing. Maybe it's the tone of an earlier film. Molly Ringwald in The New Yorker wrote a piece about 3 weeks ago, which is titled, "What About the Breakfast Club? Revisiting the Movies of My Youth in the Age of Me Too." And Molly Ringwald says she looks back here on some of those John Hughes teen comedies in a different light, looking at people's conduct and some of the sexual conduct that's portrayed in those films. With me, of course, are critics Claudia Puig and Christy Lemire. Christy, let me start with you and ask, you know, are you able to separate this stuff out, or do you look at things differently now?
It's funny you mentioned the Molly Ringwald piece about The Breakfast Club, because that's a movie that I really deeply love. And that's my teenage time. That's my formative years and my sweet spot. I actually just did Amy Nicholson's podcast, The Canon, about The Breakfast Club. We talked about this very topic. And it is interesting now to look back as an adult, at some of these 80s movies, you know, at some of the things that would definitely not fly today in terms of the portrayal of women or the portrayal of sexuality or the portrayal of permission, you know, or lack thereof. And so it's fascinating to see how dated some of those kinds of films seem. And it made me rethink The Breakfast Club and 16 Candles and all those films that were so important in the 80s. As far as, like, you know, you look at Roman Polanski films or Woody Allen films or whatever, it's really hard. It's really hard to not have that cloud in the back of your brain of just the skeeviness, the wrongness, the uncomfortable feeling that you feel revisiting some of their work, although some of the work is masterful. It's there's no good answer, and there will not be for a long time, I don't think.
Well, and Claudia, the Motion Picture Academy, in the case of Polanski, gave him the Oscar, right, for The Pianist.
Right, which a lot of people were upset about at the time, understandably so. And it seems really weird that they would wait. I mean, I understand why they did it now. I understand in the wake of Bill Cosby, but it feels tacked on to do it now. Why now? I mean, why not a long time ago?
And with no explanation, which is interesting.
Yes.
Because I'd kind of like to know, well, what is the thought process here? Because the appearance is just, well, we feel that we just cannot accept Cosby being a member of the Academy in the wake of his convictions. And, well, but if we're going to have him expelled, how can we keep Polanski?
And where do you stop? Because and where, you know, what level of behavior is, you know, Polanski wasn't, I don't believe, found guilty in a court of law.
He did plead guilty, though,
and then
in
he
a
left.
Plea deal,
okay.
Which he felt the rug was pulled out from under him. And remember the whole documentary
right.
about
That's
that.
Right.
But
yes.
Yes, he did plead, and he did not, he has not denied the incident.
But the victim has forgiven him, which is also very strange. But, I mean, there's just so much. It's so complicated. And I kind of picture the meeting, you know, people deciding, yes, of course, we have to expel Bill Cosby. And someone going, yeah, what are we going to do about Roman Polanski? And it kind of just getting lumped in there without much thought, which is maybe why there wasn't an explanation that came with it.
And Harvey Weinstein, too, I want to say, was expelled from the Academy as well.
And that's with no convictions.
With no trials. Yeah.
That's just, you know, a lot of allegations and serious allegations, but without any objective adjudication of those allegations.
And he was such an important figure within the Academy Awards for so long.
Right.
That hurts extra for him, I suppose.
All those best pictures that he made happen. Yeah.
Is this a matter, I wonder if it's a hard thing to understand, and is revoking membership or castigating them entirely a means of, you know, regaining control over a situation that is, you know, unfathomable.
And thing can't be controlled.
Yeah. Is that what it is? If it's cathartic and it's satisfying in the moment, but for the long term, is that the answer? It's
Doesn't
so hard
much.
To know.
Yeah.
Well, I'd love to hear from our Film Week listeners. Our critics setting it up very well here. So do you feel conflicted about this when you watch a film that maybe, you know, the themes you see differently now, the movies of John Hughes, or if it's someone involved with it who has had serious allegations or even conviction of sexual assault or misconduct? 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Calls for those listening live to the Friday broadcast of Film Week. I have to say, because I was older than you when the John Hughes films came out, Christy, that I winced at stuff in those Hughes films. I was in my 20s when they came out, and there was stuff I thought was retrograde, even when those movies were new, that I thought was it just seemed to me sort of unsophisticated and dated.
Me too. Well, no pun intended.
Yeah, I was going to say, hashtag me too. Yes. And he does get viewed or has been viewed for so long through this rosy, you know, gauzy cloud of nostalgia. Like, oh, it's our youth. It was the 80s. Everything was so much better back then. But yeah, a lot of things that Judd Nelson's character says, for example, to Molly Ringwald, are super inappropriate and intend to make her feel uncomfortable within that situation. And they're effective. But then she turns around and she kisses him and gives him her earring at the end. So come on,
and the
Claire.
Casual racism and homophobia,
totally.
Too. I mean, there's so much about those movies.
In 16 Candles. The
16
whole
candles.
Long Duck Dong.
16,
yeah,
long 16 Duck Candles. Yeah. Yeah. Very distasteful, that.
Yeah.
But again, you know, I'm speaking as I'm not an intended audience.
Yeah,
so
I wasn't either.
I want to make the allowance for that people would like it. But I just have to say some of that rubbed me the wrong way. The other thing is, I don't see anything wrong with portraying characters who don't take no or where, you know, there's not the information. If that's not portrayed as being okay, you know, sort of rooting
or cute
for those
or winked,
because
or,
in fact we know that stuff goes on. So if that's depicted and dealt with honestly and appropriately, I think that's fine within the, you know, construct of a film. The question is, Does the movie side with that character behaving that way or not?
Well, Breakfast Club does ultimately, because Molly Ringwald's character falls for him, even though he is horrible to her till almost the absolute end. And you know,
that's not uncommon in movies in general.
Right,
go back to 40s movies and
So we're slapping somebody and then kissing them.
Yes,
you know,
right.
And now Molly
romance.
Ringwald's having second thoughts about her. She's writing about it in the New Yorker.
Right. It's fast. As a mother, she's looking at through the mother of a daughter. She's looking at through a whole different perspective now, which is fast. And the article is great. If you guys haven't read the article, go
so
find
well-written.
It. It's so smart.
Yeah.
We're talking about how you watch films now in the wake of heightened concerns and insensitivity about sexual misconduct and sexual assault, how that factors into the films that you see, even if it's just the themes of movies that treat sexuality in ways that we would consider highly unacceptable today. Does that ruin the movie for you or not? 866 893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Pippi writes on the page, I don't know if examples in The Breakfast Club are really wrong. The entire premise of the movie was a bunch of misfits doing detention. How at the end of the day, they all came away changed. We'll continue in 1 minute. Great to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle, joined by critics Christy Lemire of RogerEbert.com and co-host of YouTube's What the Flick, and Claudia Puig, president of the LA Film Critics Association. Let's talk with listener Amber in Huntington Beach, joining us on our live 11 o'clock broadcast of Film Week. Amber, your thoughts on how you look at some of these movies now.
Yeah, as a survivor of sexual assault, I feel like once that person has been convicted and served their time or whatever their punishment is laid down by the law, once they've been, you know, once they've replaced their debt to society and they've put in their time, I don't feel like it's something that we need to continue to punish that person for and saying, oh, well, this movie's tainted or the Cosby Show is tainted because, you know, he was a serial rapist. I think that, you know, obviously he's probably going to die in prison, but it's
but you could still watch there. You could still watch the Cosby Show and appreciate it for the show itself and not have.
I feel like once you've paid your debt to society and once you've been convicted and you've put in your time and your effort, I don't feel like those are things that we need to continue to punish that person for.
Yeah.
Because they've made some poor choices, and a lot of them.
Amber, appreciate your call. Thank you so much for sharing your perspective. Ken, in Hollywood, your thoughts about this. Do you watch some of these films differently now?
I absolutely watch these films differently. I recently watched The Wedding Crashers with my wife, and that's a movie that I used to love. And we thought, oh, let's watch old movies that we liked growing up. And we couldn't get through it because the jokes are so, they're almost obscene now, especially in today's climate. And the way the men are acting actually literally made me feel like gross or just really uncomfortable. And the jokes just don't land. And I can't watch that movie anymore.
Ken, I appreciate it. Thanks. 866-893-KPECC. You can also comment on our Film Week Air Talk page at kpecc.org. Irene in Pasadena, you want to talk about the John Hughes films. Go right ahead.
Hi, I am in my 40s, so I basically grew up watching those movies. And when I was watching it at the time, I never felt it was inappropriate or was ever offended. Of course, if we watch it now with the air happening, you know, with stuff happening now, it's inappropriate. But it's almost like it's unfair to look back and say, oh, how inappropriate that was. I feel like you can't bring what's in the past, which was okay at the time, and talk about it now and criticize it at the time right now. It's almost like I watched a movie with Marlon Brando. I don't remember the title, but he brought a Japanese wife to the States, and his line was, so what? You know, I'm white, you're yellow, we'll have yellow and white children. And at that time, it was completely acceptable. But if we watch it now, it's so racist. But we can't say, oh, that was so bad. But then that's not fair because it was okay back then. I just feel like it's not fair to look back and hash out what was okay back then.
I think part of it is how emotionally does a person respond to that stuff? Claudia, you teach film, so you have a lot of, you know, young students. And I was talking about, you know, in my generation, we could, you know, watch something like Step and Fetch It in a film and have an emotional reaction to the tragedy of the portrayal, but also recognize, you know, that the talent in the performance, what it represented of its time. And I wonder, you know, can we do that? Can we bifurcate in that way?
I noticed that some of my students have a harder time doing that. And I remember loving West Side Story. I look back on that, you know, I'm Latina, and it's like, that's kind of, there's some insulting things about that. And they brought it up as an example of, you know, something very racist. And I was thinking, wow, you know, it's true. Some of these, I find that maybe the younger generation is a little bit, it's harder for them to separate it. And I don't know why that is. I don't know if it's because, you know, we're we're living in a time of, you know, where everybody's like safe spaces and political correctness. But it does seem to be harder for them.
Yeah, Irene, I think you really make a good point about derogatory language that, you know, at that time, that character in real life would have probably used language like that. And that's what's depicted in the film, even though, you know, we have a strong reaction to it today. Let's talk with Tiffany in Fountain. Tiffany, are you there? Go right ahead.
Oh, hi. This is Tiffany from Fountain Valley.
Yeah, go right ahead, please.
Oh, hi. So actually, it's funny. Last night with a classmate, we were talking about this very thing and actually referencing the John Hughes movie. So just how the ideas from the past have just completely ruined the perception of romance and consent for nowadays, where boys like my brothers who are 20 and 23 still believe that if a girl is playing hard to get, that it doesn't really mean no, that she just wants you to pursue her, that being aloof or being a jerk gets the girl. And I was just saying to a friend of mine who's in the dating world, that I was like, you know, just stop watching romantic comedies and the rom-coms, because, you know, first of all, like back in like John Hughes days, like the consent thing was just kind of so gray, like in 16 Candles, like the girl who's really intoxicated, they shove her in a car with a kid and he's making out with her when she wasn't conscious. And so it's like the world has been flipped on its ear for everybody. And but not just with consent, but just the idea that women's no doesn't mean no. And that's the images that we still see in romantic comedy.
Why do you think people accept that? I mean, if we watch a kung fu movie, we don't think that's real life or we're going to go out and do, you know, the stuff in the kung fu. What is it about the romantic comedies that crosses the line to make it somehow a person watching it thinking that that's a reflection of real life?
So I believe, like I heard a previous caller saying, oh, you can't blame the past because that was okay back then. And honestly, it's easy to say that nobody had a sense of what morality was, when really I think it's that people wanted to use their times to excuse their behavior for, like, they want what they want and they want it now. So if you blame the woman, if you blame the situation, if you blame the circumstance or the era, then you can say that they were not responsible
for
respecting a person's boundaries. So I think it was just in the time women were not very well respected, and no offense to men, but back then they wanted what they wanted.
Okay.
Tiffany,
I appreciate your call. Christy, your thoughts about, and do you feel like how these, you know, the John Hughes films, did they influence how your peers, when you're growing, what they really thought about relationships, or were they seen as sort of caricature comedies?
We could all quote them verbatim. We knew every word of 16 Candles and Breakfast Club verbatim. And I'm not sure if we look toward these films as a shining beacon of how to be, but they were, I guess, aspirational in terms of how the characters always had the right snappy thing to say at the right time, right? And nobody's like that. In real life, you don't have the
if only.
The perfect. You do,
movies
Larry.
Are always like that.
Larry,
yes.
You do, but the rest of us don't. But in terms of, you know, how they talked and all these romantic comedies, you know, it's aspirational. Like, you know, Molly Ringwald gets the man that she wants. He rescues her, but a lot of really awful stuff happens along the way that's questionable and maybe not all that romantic.
Well, we learn our behavior from romantic comedies. That's how we learn how to be sort of, you know, how to date, because we're not taught by our parents, right?
All right. I want to thank our critics, as always, Claudia Puig, Christy Lemire, for joining us. Carolyn in Pasadena says, I think depends on whether or not the art can be judged independently of who made it. I understand giving the past some flack, but, you know, a movie like Wedding Crasher wasn't all that long ago. Very good point. Thank you so much for joining us, and I hope to see you Saturday night, June 2nd, Theater at Ace Hotel for the next Film Week screening, The Graduate. We'll see it on the big screen together. Post-film conversation. I sure hope you join us. Tickets available at kpcc.org/in-person. Have a great day.